Chapter 23. I say, if you help this institution, you will be helping the wagoner who has resolutely put his own shoulder to the wheel, and who has not stuck idle in the mud. In giving this aid, you will be doing an act of justice, and you will be performing an act of gratitude. And this is what I solicit from you. But I will not so far wrong those who are struggling manfully for their own independence, as to pretend to entreat from you an act of charity. I have used the word gratitude, and let any man ask his own heart, and confess if he have not some grateful acknowledgments for the actor's art, not peculiarly because it is a profession often pursued, and as it were marked, by poverty and misfortune for other callings, God knows, have their distresses, nor because the actor has sometimes to come from scenes of sickness, of suffering, even of death itself, to play his part before us for all of us, in our spheres, have as often to do violence to our feelings, and to hide our hearts in fighting this great battle of life, and in discharging our duties and responsibilities. But the art of the actor excites reflections, somber or grotesque, awful or humorous, which we are all familiar with. If any man were to tell me that he denied his acknowledgments to the stage, I would simply put to him one question: whether he remembered his first play? If you, gentlemen, will but carry back your recollection to that great night, and call to mind the bright and harmless world which then opened to your view, we shall, I think, hear favorably of the effect upon your liberality on this occasion from our secretary. This is the sixth year of meetings of this kind, the sixth time we have had this fine child down after dinner. His nurse, a very worthy person of the name of Buckstone, who has an excellent character from several places, will presently report to you that his chest is perfectly sound, and that his general health is in the most thriving condition. Long may it be so. Long may it thrive and grow. Long may we meet. It is my sincere wish to exchange our congratulations on its prosperity, and longer than the line of Banquo may be that line of figures which, as its patriotic share in the national debt, a century hence shall be stated by the Governor and Company of the Bank of England. Speech. The Royal Literary Fund. London, March 12, 1856. The Corporation of the Royal Literary Fund was established in 1790, its object being to administer assistance to authors of genius and learning, who may be reduced to distress by unavoidable calamities, or deprived, by enfeebled faculties or declining life, of the power of literary exertion. At the annual general meeting held at the house of the Society on the above date, the following speech was made by Mr. Charles Dickens.
Sir, I shall not attempt to follow my friend Mr. Bell, who, in the profession of literature, represents upon this committee a separate and distinct branch of the profession, that, like the last rose of summer, stands blooming alone, while all its companions are faded and gone, into the very prickly bramble bush with which he has ingeniously contrived to beset this question. In the remarks I have to make, I shall confine myself to 4 points. 1. That the committee find themselves in the painful condition of not spending enough money, and will presently apply themselves to the great reform of spending more. 2. That with regard to the house, it is a positive matter of history, that the house for which Mr. Williams was so anxious was to be applied to uses to which it never has been applied, and which the administrators of the fund decline to recognize. 3. That, in Mr. Bell's endeavors to remove the artist's fund from the ground of analogy it unquestionably occupies with reference to this fund, by reason of their continuing periodical relief to the same persons, I beg to tell Mr. Bell, what every gentleman at that table knows, that it is the business of this fund to relieve over and over again the same people. Mr. Bell. But fresh inquiry is always made first. Mr. C. Dickens. I can only oppose to that statement my own experience, when I sat on that committee, and when I have known persons relieved on many consecutive occasions without further inquiry being made. As to the suggestion that we should select the items of expenditure that we complain of, I think it is according to all experience that we should first affirm the principle that the expenditure is too large. If that be done by the meeting, then I will proceed to the selection of the separate items. Now, in rising to support this resolution, I may state at once that I have scarcely any expectation of its being carried, and I am happy to think it will not. Indeed, I consider it the strongest point of the resolution's case that it should not be carried, because it will show the determination of the fund's managers. Nothing can possibly be stronger in favor of the resolution than that the statement should go forth to the world that twice within 12 months the attention of the committee has been called to this great expenditure, and twice the committee have considered that it was not unreasonable. I cannot conceive a stronger case for the resolution than this statement of fact as to the expenditure going forth to the public accompanied by the committee's assertion that it is reasonable. Now, to separate this question from details, let us remember what the committee and their supporters asserted last year, and, I hope, will reassert this year. It seems to be rather the model kind of thing than otherwise now that, if you get £100 you are to spend £40 in management, and if you get £1,000, of course you may spend £400 in giving the rest away. Now, in case there should be any ill-conditioned people here who may ask what occasion there can be for all this expenditure, I will give you my experience. I went last year to a highly respectable place of resort, Willis's Rooms, in St. James, to a meeting of this fund. My original intention was to hear all I could, and say as little as possible. Allowing for the absence of the younger and fairer portion of the creation, the general appearance of the place was something like Almack's in the morning. A number of stately old dowagers sat in a row on one side, and old gentlemen on the other. The ball was opened with due solemnity by a real marquis, who walked a minuet with the secretary, at which the audience were much affected. Then another party advanced, who, I am sorry to say, was only a member of the House of Commons, and he took possession of the floor. To him, however, succeeded a lord, then a bishop, then the son of a distinguished lord, then one or two celebrities from the City and Stock Exchange, and at last a gentleman, who made a fortune by the success of Candide, sustained the part of Pangloss, and spoke much of what he evidently believed to be the very best management of this best of all possible funds. Now it is in this fondness for being stupendously genteel, and keeping up fine appearances this vulgar and common social vice of hanging on to great connections at any price, that the money goes. The last time you got a distinguished writer at a public meeting, and he was called on to address you somewhere amongst the small hours, he told you he felt like the man in plush who was permitted to sweep the stage down after all the other people had gone. If the founder of this society were here, I should think he would feel like a sort of Rip Van Winkle reversed, who had gone to sleep backwards for 100 years, and woke up to find his fund still lying under the feet of people who did nothing for it instead of being emancipated and standing alone long ago. This Bloomsbury House is another part of the same desire for show, and the officer who inhabits it. I mean, of course, in his official capacity, for, as an individual, I much respect him. When one enters the house it appears to be haunted by a series of mysterious-looking ghosts, who glide about engaged in some extraordinary occupation, and, after the approved fashion of ghosts, but seldom condescend to disclose their business. What are all these meetings and inquiries wanted for? As for the authors, I say, as a writer by profession, that the long inquiry said to be necessary to ascertain whether an applicant deserves relief is a preposterous pretense, and that working literary men would have a far better knowledge of the cases coming before the board than can ever be attained by that committee. Further, I say openly and plainly that this fund is pompously and unnaturally administered at great expense, instead of being quietly administered at small expense, and that the secrecy to which it lays claim as its greatest attribute is not kept, for through those two respectable householders, to whom reference must be made, the names of the most deserving applicants are two numbers of people perfectly well known. The members have now got before them a plain statement of fact as to these charges, and it is for them to say whether they are justifiable, becoming, or decent. I beg most earnestly and respectfully to put it to those gentlemen who belong to this institution that must now decide, and cannot help deciding, what the literary fund is for, and what it is not for. The question raised by the resolution is whether this is a public corporation for the relief of men of genius and learning, or whether it is a snug, traditional, and conventional party, bent upon maintaining its own usages with a vast amount of pride, upon its own annual puffery at costly dinner tables, and upon a course of expensive toadying to a number of distinguished individuals. This is the question which you cannot this day escape. Speech. London, November 5, 1857. At the fourth anniversary dinner of the Warehousemen and Clerks' Schools, which took place on Thursday evening, November 5, 1857 at the London Tavern, and was very numerously attended, Mr. Charles Dickens occupied the chair. On the subject which had brought the company together, Mr. Dickens spoke as follows.
I must now solicit your attention for a few minutes to the cause of your assembling together, the main and real object of this evening's gathering, for I suppose we are all agreed that the motto of these tables is not let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die, but let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we live. It is because a great and good work is to live tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, and to live a greater and better life with every succeeding tomorrow, that we eat and drink here at all. Conspicuous on the card of admission to this dinner is the word schools. This set me thinking this morning, what are the sorts of schools that I don't like? I found them on consideration to be rather numerous. I don't like to begin with, and to begin as charity does at home, I don't like the sort of school to which I once went myself, the respected proprietor of which was by far the most ignorant man I have ever had the pleasure to know, one of the worst tempered men perhaps that ever lived, whose business it was to make as much out of us, and put as little into us as possible, and who sold us at a figure which I remember we used to delight to estimate, as amounting to exactly £2.60 per head. I don't like that sort of school, because I don't see what business the master had to be at the top of it instead of the bottom, and because I never could understand the wholesomeness of the moral preached by the abject appearance and degraded condition of the teachers who plainly said to us by their looks every day of their lives, "Boys, never be learned. Whatever you are, above all things, be warned from that in time by our sunken cheeks, by our poor pimply noses, by our meager diet, by our acid beer, and by our extraordinary suits of clothes, of which no human being can say whether they are snuff-colored turned black, or black turned snuff-colored, a point upon which we ourselves are perfectly unable to offer any ray of enlightenment. It is so very long since they were undarned and new. I do not like that sort of school, because I have never yet lost my ancient suspicion touching that curious coincidence, that the boy with four brothers, to come always got the prizes. In fact, and short, I do not like that sort of school, which is a pernicious and abominable humbug, altogether. Again, ladies and gentlemen, I don't like that sort of school, a ladies' school with which the other school used to dance on Wednesdays, where the young ladies, as I look back upon them now, seem to me always to have been in new stays and disgrace the latter concerning a place, of which I know nothing at this day, that bounds Timbuktu on the northeast, and where memory always depicts the youthful enthraller of my first affection as forever standing against a wall, in a curious machine of wood, which confined her innocent feet in the first dancing position, while those arms, which should have encircled my jacket. Those precious arms, I say, were pinioned behind her by an instrument of torture called a backboard, fixed in the manner of a double direction post. Again, I don't like that sort of school, of which we have a notable example in Kent, which was established ages ago by worthy scholars and good men long deceased, whose munificent endowments have been monstrously perverted from their original purpose, and which, in their distorted condition, are struggled for and fought over with the most indecent pertinacity. Again, I don't like that sort of school, and I have seen a great many such in these latter times, where the bright childish imagination is utterly discouraged, and where those bright childish faces, which it is so very good for the wisest among us to remember in after life, when the world is too much with us, early and late, 22, are gloomily and grimly scared out of countenance. Where I have never seen among the pupils, whether boys or girls, anything but little parrots and small calculating machines. Again, I don't by any means like schools in leather breeches, and with mortified straw baskets for bonnets, which file along the streets in long melancholy rows under the escort of that surprising British monster a beadle, whose system of instruction, I am afraid, too often presents that happy union of sound with sense, of which a very remarkable instance is given in a grave report of a trustworthy school inspector, to the effect that a boy in great repute at school for his learning, presented on his slate, as one of the Ten Commandments, the perplexing prohibition, "Thou shalt not commit doldrum." Ladies and gentlemen, I confess, also, that I don't like those schools, even though the instruction given in them be gratuitous, where those sweet little voices which ought to be heard speaking in very different accents, anathematized by rote any human being who does not hold what is taught there. Lastly, I do not like, and I did not like some years ago, cheap distant schools, where neglected children pine from year to year under an amount of neglect, want, and youthful misery far too sad, even to be glanced at in this cheerful assembly. And now, ladies and gentlemen, perhaps you will permit me to sketch in a few words the sort of school that I do like. It is a school established by the members of an industrious and useful order, which supplies the comforts and graces of life at every familiar turning in the road of our existence. It is a school established by them for the orphan and necessitous children of their own brethren and sisterhood. It is a place giving an education worthy of them, an education by them invented, by them conducted, by them watched over. It is a place of education where, while the beautiful history of the Christian religion is daily taught, and while the life of that divine teacher who himself took little children on his knees is daily studied, no sectarian ill will nor narrow human dogma is permitted to darken the face of the clear heaven which they disclose. It is a children's school, which is at the same time no less a children's home, a home not to be confided to the care of cold or ignorant strangers, nor, by the nature of its foundation, in the course of ages, to pass into hands that have as much natural right to deal with it as with the peaks of the highest mountains or with the depths of the sea, but to be from generation to generation administered by men living in precisely such homes as those poor children have lost, by men always bent upon making that replacement, such a home as their own dear children might find a happy refuge in if they themselves were taken early away. And I fearlessly ask you, is this a design which has any claim to your sympathy? Is this a sort of school which is deserving of your support? This is the design, this is the school, whose strong and simple claim I have to lay before you tonight. I must particularly entreat you not to suppose that my fancy and unfortunate habit of fiction has anything to do with the picture I have just presented to you. It is sober matter of fact. The warehouseman and clerk's schools, established for the maintaining, clothing, and educating of the orphan and necessitous children of those employed in the wholesale trades and manufactures of the United Kingdom, are, in fact, what I have just described. These schools for both sexes. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.